Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Phil Dierking will have this week's education report. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Ashley tells us about a popular event among Uyghurs in the United States.
The World Cup in Russia has received attention all around the world. But one immigrant community has had its attention on a different soccer event. It takes place at a high school stadium outside Washington, D.C. Instead of a battle between nations, it is a gathering of teams of the same ethnicity. Welcome to the Uyghur American Cup. Now in its fourth year, the event brings together ethnic Uyghur soccer players and fans from across North America. Seven teams compete for the championship. They represent the Uyghur communities in places like Los Angeles, Northern Virginia, New York City, and even Toronto, Canada. The five-day event is one that Kudret never wants to miss. He lives in Princeton, New Jersey, and is a member of the Boston, New York Uyghur Football Club. The closest Uyghurs to his home, he says, are more than an hour away by car.
For me personally, not just the sport itself, because we all can play it in our respective residences where we live. It's more of the brotherhood we feel. You know, we share of same roots. And mainly because there aren't many Uyghurs living in the United States compared to other immigrant communities. This is once in a year, something that on a personal level I never want to miss.
Uyghurs are a mostly Muslim ethnic group in Central Asia. About 10 million of them live in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China, a huge area in the country's northwest. There are also large populations of Uyghurs in countries like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkey. In recent years, China has introduced one of the world's most aggressive policing programs in Xinjiang. Security checkpoints and high-tech surveillance cameras are everywhere. Government officials say they are fighting a rise in Islamic extremism, as well as a separatist movement that calls for an independent Uyghur nation. Uyghurs living in China face severe restrictions, rights groups say. For many, acts such as practicing Islam, studying the Uyghur language, and communicating with friends and family overseas come with great risks. Recent media reports confirm that hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs have been sent to extrajudicial political re-education camps. The Associated Press reports that some Uyghurs remain in the camps for months without formally being charged with anything. Slowly but surely, Uyghur soccer fans of all ages fill the seats at the Lee High School Stadium in Springfield, Virginia. It is the opening day of the 2018 Uyghur American Cup. It is also July 4th, America's Independence Day. Some arrive wearing red, white, and blue USA clothing including Tahir. He came to the United States earlier this year. Seeing such a large gathering of Uyghurs makes him feel as if we were at home, he says.
Making America as our second home, we are feeling that America provide us safety from the Chinese oppression and provide us a place to be united.
Northern Virginia has two all-Uyghur soccer teams, Taklamakan, the 2018 tournament host, and Uyghur United, the three-time defending Uyghur American Cup champions. The area is home to one of the largest Uyghur communities in North America. Arafat lives in Northern Virginia. He is captain of the Uyghur United soccer team and one of the leaders of the tournament. He helped organize the first ever Uyghur American Cup in 2015.
I think soccer is an excellent way to bring the Uyghur people together because, you know, it's in our blood to like sports. When you get into politics or a certain area, a lot of people seem to have, you know, different perspectives, different political views. But when it comes to soccer, everyone wants to come have fun, support their favorite team. Just a chance for all the family members to be out there, you know, just have fun overall.
Nurpari is 15 years old and a Uyghur American. She comes to the tournament with her family and friends each year, she says.
And it's really, like, nice to see, your, like, people from your country playing soccer since they don't have their own actual team. So it's nice to see them go against each other.
Yashar and Filora live in Northern Virginia. They decided at the last minute to come to the opening day of the Uyghur American Cup. They had just finished watching a World Cup match.
We just came back from actually a World Cup event, but this is bigger.
Yeah, yes. Like more important to us to come to here.
No politics, no other things involved, just purely sportsmen, just a love for the sports.
For many, the event goes beyond sport as well. Amir plays for Uyghur United. He says the most important thing the tournament does is help Uyghurs form connections and friendships.
I get to see my fellow brothers and sisters from other states who I did not get to see. It's as if we just saw each other yesterday because it's just that bond that we establish, and that's something we want the younger generations to establish and see as well.
Before play begins, all seven teams line up on the soccer field. The players' young children join them. The crowd cheers as each team is introduced. Arafat says he hopes to use this year's tournament to identify talent and form a so-called dream team of Uyghur soccer players.
The ultimate goal is to eventually form a national Uyghur football club and then be able to represent Uyghur people on the international stage.
For now, though, the seven all-Uyghur clubs are competitors. Coming in, the other teams know it will take a lot to beat Uyghur United. The team plays weekly and has been around since 2005, much longer than any of the other teams. Amir says his team feels some pressure to win again. There's more pressure on us, but in a fun, competitive way, he says. As expected, Uyghur United makes it to the championship match. So does Uyghur Bogda Football Club, the team from Toronto. With a final score of 2-1, Uyghur United wins its fourth Uyghur American Cup title in a row. Even though Nurpari loves to play and watch soccer, she says she was not focused on the final results of the tournament.
I'm not really specifically rooting for any team, since we're all Uyghur. Whoever wins, I'll be happy anyway.
We'll be right back.
The Trump administration announced last week that it would not urge schools to consider race in the admissions process. The administration withdrew official guidance meant to increase student diversity at schools across the United States. That guidance was developed during the presidency of Barack Obama. The move gives schools and colleges the federal government's permission to leave race out of admissions decisions. It is evidence of the politics that have long surrounded affirmative action policies. Those policies have repeatedly been at the center of cases heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Obama administration guidance was among 24 policy documents withdrawn by the Justice Department for being unnecessary, outdated, or not meeting existing law. Attorney General Jeff Sessions described the changes as an effort to reestablish the rule of law. Yet, civil rights groups criticized the move, and some university officials said they plan to continue their diversity efforts as before. The Supreme Court's most recent decision on the subject approved of the use of race in the admission process. But Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the court's opinion, plans to retire at the end of July. This gives President Donald Trump a chance to appoint someone who may be more critical of admissions programs that take race and ethnicity into consideration. The new policy is a big change from the thinking of the Obama administration, which had often said schools could consider race in admissions decisions to support diversity. In one 2011 document, the administration said courts had recognized schools' compelling interest in supporting racially diverse populations. Institutions are not required to implement race-neutral approaches if, in their judgment, the approaches would be unworkable, the document said. It added that, in some cases, such methods will be ineffective to creating the diversity the school seeks. That guidance has now been withdrawn. So were similar documents, including some which tried to explain court rulings supporting the use of race in admissions decisions. The Trump administration's Justice Department had already expressed concern about the use of race in admissions decisions. This year, it supported Asian American claimants who said Harvard University unlawfully limits how many Asian students are admitted. Harvard said it would continue considering race to create a diverse campus community where students from all walks of life have the opportunity to learn with and from each other. Civil rights groups criticized the Trump administration's move. They say it went against many years of court decisions permitting colleges to consider race for admissions. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law released a statement from Kristen Clark, its president and executive director. It reads, "We condemn the Department of Education's politically motivated attack on affirmative action and deliberate attempt to discourage colleges and universities from pursuing racial diversity at our nation's colleges and universities." Lily Eskelson Garcia is president of the National Education Association. She said, "Affirmative action has proven to be one of the most effective ways to create diverse and inclusive classrooms." She said the announcement signals the importance of Trump's Supreme Court appointment. The new affirmative action guidance may add to U.S. congressional debate over Justice Kennedy's replacement. The Associated Press reports that Howard University Law School Dean Danielle Holly Walker criticized the new guidance. She said it is another sign that the Justice Department is likely to target schools that do continue to use race in admissions decisions. This is a clear attack on past legal decisions, Holly Walker said, and that any Supreme Court nominee needs to be asked if they support past decisions on affirmative action. I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941 was one of the most successful surprise attacks in the history of modern warfare. Japanese warships, including several aircraft carriers, crossed the Western Pacific to Hawaii without being seen. They launched their planes on a quiet Sunday morning and attacked the huge American naval and air base at Pearl Harbor.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war.
Many of the American military personnel were asleep or at church. They were totally unprepared for the attack. In fact, some people outside the base thought the Japanese planes must be new types of American aircraft on training flights. The sounds of guns and bombs soon showed how wrong they were. The Japanese planes sank or seriously damaged six powerful American battleships in just a few minutes. They killed more than 3,000 sailors. They destroyed or damaged half the American airplanes in Hawaii. American forces, caught by surprise, were unable to offer much of a fight. Japanese losses were very low. There was so much destruction at Pearl Harbor that officials in Washington did not immediately reveal the full details to the public. They were afraid that Americans might panic if they learned the truth about the loss of so much military power. The following day, President Franklin Roosevelt went to Congress to ask for a declaration of war against Japan.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. We will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
The Senate approved President Roosevelt's request without any opposition. In the House of Representatives, only one congressman objected to the declaration of war against Japan. Three days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. Congress reacted by declaring war on those two countries. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor ended the long American debate over whether to become involved in the Second World War. American politicians and citizens had argued for years about whether to remain neutral or to fight to help Britain and France and other friends. Japan's aggressive attack at Pearl Harbor united Americans in a common desire for military victory. It made Americans willing to do whatever was necessary to win the war. And it pushed America into a kind of world leadership that its people had never known before. President Roosevelt and his advisors had to make an important decision about how to fight the war. Would the United States fight Japan first, or Germany, or both at the same time? Japan's attack had brought America into the war, and it had severely damaged American military power. But Roosevelt decided not to strike back at Japan immediately. He would use most of his forces to fight Germany. There were several reasons for Roosevelt's decision. First, Germany already controlled much of Europe, as well as much of the Atlantic Ocean. Roosevelt considered this a direct threat, and he worried about possible German intervention in Latin America. Second, Germany was an advanced industrial nation. It had many scientists and engineers. Its factories were modern. Roosevelt was concerned that Germany might be able to develop deadly new weapons, such as an atomic bomb, if it was not stopped quickly. Third, Britain historically was one of America's closest allies, and the British people were united and fighting for their lives against Germany. This was not true in Asia. Japan's most important opponent was China. But China's fighting forces were weak and divided and could not offer strong opposition to the Japanese. Adolf Hitler's decision to break his non-aggression treaty with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and attack the Soviet Union made Roosevelt's choice final. The American president recognized that the Germans would have to fight on two fronts, in the West against Britain and in the East against Russia. He decided it was best to attack Germany while its forces were divided. So the United States sent most of its troops and supplies to Britain to join the fight against Germany. American military leaders hoped to attack Germany quickly by launching an attack across the English Channel. Stalin also supported this plan. Soviet forces were suffering terrible losses from the Nazi attack and wanted the British and Americans to fight the Germans on the west. However, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and other leaders opposed launching an invasion across the English Channel too quickly. They worried that such an invasion might fail while the Germans were still so strong, and they knew this would mean disaster. For this reason, British and American forces decided instead to attack the Italian and German troops occupying North Africa. British forces had been fighting the Italians and Germans in North Africa since late 1940. They fought the Italians first in Egypt and Libya. British forces had successfully pushed the Italians across Libya. They killed more than 10,000 Italian troops and captured more than 130,000 prisoners. But the British success did not last long. Hitler sent one of his best commanders, General Erwin Rommel, to take command of the Italians. Rommel was brave and smart. He pushed the British back from Libya to the border with Egypt. And in a giant battle at Tobruk, he destroyed or captured more than 800 of Britain's 900 tanks. Rommel's progress threatened Egypt and the Suez Canal. So Britain and the United States moved quickly to send more troops and supplies to stop him. Slowly, British forces, led by General Bernard Montgomery, pushed Rommel and the Germans back to Tripoli in Libya. In November 1942, American and British forces, commanded by General Dwight Eisenhower, landed in Northwest Africa. They planned to attack Rommel from the west, while Montgomery attacked him from the east. But Rommel knew Eisenhower's troops had done little fighting before, so he attacked them quickly before they could launch their own attack. A major battle took place at Kasserine Pass in western Tunisia. American forces suffered heavy losses, but in the end, Rommel's attack failed. 3 months later, American forces joined with Montgomery's British troops to force the Germans in North Africa to surrender. The Battle of North Africa was over. The Allied forces of Britain and the United States had regained control of the southern Mediterranean Sea. They could now attack Hitler's forces in Europe from the south. The Allies wasted no time. They landed on the Italian island of Sicily in July of 1943. German tanks fought back, but the British and American forces moved ahead. Soon they captured Sicily's capital, Palermo, and within weeks they forced the German forces to leave Sicily for the Italian mainland. In late July, Italy's dictator, Benito Mussolini, was overthrown and placed in prison. The Germans rescued him and helped him establish a new government protected by German troops. But still, the Allies attacked. They crossed to the Italian mainland. The Germans fought hard, and for some time they prevented the Allied troops from breaking out of the coastal areas. The fighting grew bloodier. A fierce battle took place at Monte Cassino. Thousands of soldiers lost their lives. But slowly, the Allies advanced north through Italy. They captured Rome in June of 1944, and they forced the Germans back into the mountains of northern Italy. The Allies would not gain complete control of Italy until the end of the war, but they had succeeded in increasing their control of the Mediterranean and pushing back the Germans. One reason Hitler's forces were not stronger in Africa and Italy was because German armies also were fighting in Russia.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.